Get started when you're ready.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. I would like to call the if we can give some board members 2 minutes.
Okay.
Oh, I got to push to say hello.
Yeah, you see how this red thing?
Yeah, yeah, okay.
If you see that? That's how it'll be.
It's on when it's red.
Yeah, when you speak into it, it'll be.
Hello, Terry.
I'm here.
Perfect. I think we're ready. Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to call the order of the September 1st, 2021 meeting of the TPA Citizen Advisory Committee. The Palm Beach TPA is conducting this meeting in both in person and virtually using the Zoom webinar platform. Instruction to join the virtual meeting as well as contact information for assistance are provided on the published meeting agenda. Staff at this time, please call roll and establish a quorum.
Before I call the roll, I want to remind members present in person to unmute your microphones by pushing the button on the base prior to responding. Members present virtually, please remember to unmute yourselves. So Ramona Bean. I don't have that. She's joined yet. James Bonfiglio.
Here.
Terry Brown.
Here.
Mark Bruner.
Here.
Michael Carter. Michael Carter, just want to make sure it's not a general attendee. Okay. Greg Fagan.
Here.
Michael Fitzpatrick.
Here.
Mark Forrest.
Attending.
James Garvin.
Here.
Francisco Paco Gill.
Here.
Vijay Mishra.
Here.
Ryan Rossi.
Here.
Paula Ryan.
Here.
Myra Newman.
Here.
Richard Vasilotti.
Here.
Cheryl Snyder.
Here.
Albert Ridgewagon.
Present.
Wen Deng. We have a quorum, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any modifications to the agenda?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, we're going to move to item 1C. Are there any changes to the minutes? If not, can I have a motion to adopt the minutes as presented?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Okay, motion carries. Next item, as a reminder, there's the general public comments. There are three ways to provide public comments for this meeting. One is written comments may be submitted online at the website provided on the agenda. Verbal comments may be made in virtual attendees using the raise hand function featured in the Zoom platform. And then lastly, verbal and written comments may be provided in an in-person attendee submitting comment cards available at the welcome desk in the front door. Are there any general comments at this time?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. So moving to the next item, comments from the chair and members. We have new members this time. It's very exciting. I'd like to welcome James as nominated by Commissioner Sock and then Paco Am I saying it correctly?
Yes.
Nominated by Commissioner Lambert, and these are our two latest appointees. So I'd like to give them the floor and introduce yourselves to the committee.
Okay, you're doing this, what, alphabetical by height?
since we're all sitting down, so okay. I'm going to start with you, James.
Great. Hi, my name is Jim Bonfiglio. I've lived in Palm Beach County since 1978. And I've lived in Ocean Ridge since around 1987. I've been on the Ocean Ridge Planning and Zoning Commission as the vice chair and chair for around 13 years. I was a two-term commissioner, served 1 year as vice mayor and 1 year as mayor. I've been an attorney in Palm Beach County for 42 years. I'm mostly retired now. I did mortgage foreclosure defense work. I was vice president, president of the Italian American Bar Association, on the board of directors of Palm Beach County now, and now PAC and the legislative director. So that's a little bit of my background in my history in Palm Beach County. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And then Paco.
My name is Francisco Gil, but everybody knows me as Paco. I've been in West Palm Beach for 17 years. Since then, I've always been living in downtown. I work for a family office, a group of companies by the Morrison family. We have a large presence of a big portfolio of real estate in the area. Plus, we have a big presence in the community. In the area, we have more than 2,000 employees. You may know some of our businesses. We own approximately 40 different restaurants. One of them is the Duffy's chain that I'm sure everybody's familiar with. And then many other restaurants in Palm Beach County, plus other businesses, dry cleanings and other things. So we are very, very involved in the community, and we want to be participating there. So, and that's my background.
All right. Well, thank you so much and welcome. And I'm really excited to see the committee filling up. We do have 5 vacant positions left in here. As a reminder, for City of Green Acres, Town Jupiter, Riviera Beach, Lake Worth, and Belgrade. So I'm looking forward as new members join us.
Madam Chair, I'm from the Town of Jupiter.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. This is Margie. We do have Cheryl Snyder from the Town of Jupiter. There was an error on our agenda.
Okay.
That we failed to include her. So my apologies, Cheryl and Madam Chair.
I just want to let you know I'm here.
I apologize, Cheryl. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Cheryl Schneider. I actually attended the last meeting in person, and so was able to introduce myself then. But I've been in Jupiter for about 8 years. I'm currently vice chair of the Planning and Zoning Commission. I've been on there for about 5 years, and I'm very active in all the issues in Jupiter. And I was appointed by Councilor Jim Koretsky. And so I'm very excited to join and see what I can do to help Jupiter. Thank you.
All right, great. So moving on to item 1F, the CAC liaison report. Jason.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Now I'll go over the liaison report for September. First item we have is bicycle-friendly designations. This is a bicycle-friendly business designation that's offered through the League of American Bicyclists, and it's based on the belief that bikes are good for business, employees, and the community. And applications for a bike-friendly business program are due by October 5th, next month. And for more information, visit bikeleague.org/BFA. Next, the TPA is currently conducting a multimodal corridor study for Okeechobee Boulevard and State Route 7. So it goes from downtown Okeechobee Boulevard all the way out west to State Route 7 and then goes south on State Route 7 almost to the Wellington Mall. And so through conducting this public workshop, it'll be ongoing for the next few months, and we're looking for participation. And the The workshop will provide the public an opportunity to learn more about the study and provide feedback on how you can participate and learn more about the corridor and provide input and comments. And to do so, you go to palmbeachtpa.org/OKEE, O-K-E-E. And we encourage you to go there, learn more about the project, and provide some input along that corridor during this planning phase. Next, the local coordinating board is seeking new members, and this is the Transportation Disadvantaged Local Coordinating Board. So they're looking for to bring on new members, similar to what we are doing here for the CAC, bringing on additional members and filling up the board. And so the LCB is seeking members for the role of representatives for children at risk and representatives for the elderly. And for more information about how to apply, contact Kelsey Peterson here at the TPA at kpeterson@palmbeachtpa.org. There's also the Everyday Counts Safety Summit series. And so FHWA is hosting a safety webinars every Wednesday in September. And the summit series highlights safety initiatives and shares how you can save lives on the roadway. So for more information, you would go to palmbeachtpa.org/everyday counts. So we're hosting that on our website at palmbeachtpa.org. Next is the TPA governing board meeting. The next governing board meeting is scheduled for September 16th, 2021 at 9 a.m. here in the building as well as virtually. And so to view the agenda packet for that upcoming meeting, you can visit our website again at palmbeachtpa.org/board. And FDOT is sponsoring a webinar series called the Transplex Safety Web Series. And so through this, FDOT is having a web series every Friday in October where they'll focus on elements of the safe system approach to eliminate fatalities and serious injuries on the roadway. So to view some of these webinars and to register, you would go to fdot.gov/planning/transplex. And that last part is TRANSPLEX. And again, we have the high visibility enforcement funding, and this is being offered through alerttodayflorida.com/HVE. And this is high visibility enforcement funding for officers on the roadway to educate and look for opportunities to kind of make it more visible and enforce bicycle and pedestrian visibility. And last is the Complete Streets video. The TPA has just completed our Complete Streets video that showcases roadways in our area. And we've developed a video that we'd like to show now, and we're gonna play it for you so you can check out our video that we just completed.
Palm Beach Transportation Planning Agency, or TPA for short, plans, prioritizes, and funds transportation projects in Palm Beach County. The TPA's vision is a safe, efficient, and connected multimodal transportation system. One of the ways to achieve this vision is through Complete Streets. Complete Streets are designed for users of all ages and abilities, including transit riders, bicyclists, and pedestrians. Let's hear about some of the Complete Streets projects across Palm Beach County and Florida.
US 1, a federal highway, which was a highway that was running through our downtown, high speeds, lots of accident history. It was a natural blockade for pedestrians. They would stop and not want to cross a four-lane highway with cars speeding by.
This is Okeechobee Boulevard. It is designed for fast-moving vehicles to go in and out of the city. And that's not necessarily what the values of the city has, or the citizen of the city has.
This is an old town. We have been established for 70 years, and this road, US 1, has been there for a lot longer than that. We didn't have decorative lighting. We had very narrow sidewalks up there.
What is the root cause of why our streets are so unsafe? And it comes down to how we design it. And we design it for cars, and we design it for speed.
When I hear from friends and relatives who live elsewhere in the country or in the state, and they see the activities that we're doing to create an environment that is welcoming for everyone, for people in vehicles, for pedestrians, and for cyclists, they want to move here. And we want to make sure that everyone feels safe and welcome here.
We were notified by the Florida Department of Transportation that they were going to come in and simply repave a 6-lane stretch of US Highway 1. And we thought we would take advantage of that time to be able to look at something that would be bicycle friendly, pedestrian friendly. The concern was it's different. It's changing. I've always been able to have 6 lanes on this highway. It wasn't so much that it was a bad idea. It just wasn't something they expected or wanted. And that was until we got this project really done.
Well, it was about 6 years ago when the city of Delreach reached out to the school and let us know that this was an improvement that they were considering. We spoke about it with our SAC members, our community stakeholders, who also had concerns about the safety of students coming and going. Everyone was 100% in favor of it.
We had an engineering firm come in and take out a lane with little barriers that didn't look so good for about a year to study the traffic impact. And what we learned was we were able to slow speeds by between 6 and 10 miles an hour, depending where you were on the corridor. The accident history on in the study area went down 50%, which is extremely significant. And at the intersection of US 1 and Atlantic Avenue, we saw a 75% reduction in traffic accidents.
The great thing about living around here, at least on Cumberland, is that when I do go out for a bike ride, I am safe. I have what some people might call armadillos along the road that separate the bike lane from the car lane. It really does add a layer of protection for the biker.
We said, you know, it's not good business to have people driving 65 miles an hour past your main street. We have to slow it down, which is good for the economy. Once the narrowing came in and the bike lanes were added and the landscaping was added, people start to see what it could be. So the potential takes over. And what we did is we turned a highway into a neighborhood.
There are less parents driving because the kids that live closer are now able to walk. So it's offloaded the number of cars that are coming and going in the afternoon.
So by interconnecting the roadways for bicyclists and vehicles and pedestrians, it gives all residents the ability to have access to resources in the neighborhood, such as medical resources, job opportunities, educational opportunities, and that's what we want.
But I truly believe that if we work together and that we all know what the end goal is, that we can get there.
As we've seen, complete streets can help create a safe, efficient, and connected multimodal transportation system. The TPA looks forward to working with local municipalities to implement complete streets projects across Palm Beach County. To learn more, go to palmbeachtpa.org/complete streets.
Okay, so that's the recently completed video. You can find it on our website as well. And you may have noticed one of our very own, Wen, was in the video as well. So she's this is a great cameo there. And I have one more item to conclude with, and that is the follow-up. In a few months ago, we had a request to reach out to FDOT to request them to revisit their checklist for approval of the Transportation Improvement Program and the checklist that I used to go for consistency with the LRTP. And I reached out to them and went back and forth with them about their checklist, and they are going to update it for next year, but I don't think they don't plan on acting on including additional questions about financial consistency between the long-range transportation plan and the transportation improvement plan. So between those two, there won't be necessarily any detailed financial questions, but they are going to revisit and take another look at their the review sheet that I use, the checklist that I use through that process. And so that's the last item on the liaison report.
All right, thank you so much. I see Myron, you have your hands up.
Madam Chair, if I may, before Myron starts, I want to note that Ramona being joined the meeting in person, as well as there's no public comments on this item.
All right, thank you so much. Myron.
I had a question about item number six. I think it was number six on the FDOT safety web series Transflex or something like that. What, Jason, do you know what audience FDOT is trying to reach in this? Is it a technical audience or a public audience? Just what is the purpose of this? You know.
I believe I've been watching a lot of webinars lately, so I don't know if I've checked out one of these directly, but I would think because it's on their general website that it's open to the public. It does probably have some element of details in it, but I would think that they would kind of scale it to a wider audience, so it's understandable by the general public, as well as still be inviting and of interest to people with engineers or planners that are looking to kind of glean more information and maybe take it back to public works departments or commissioners to take action on. So,
let's see, I would guess it would be more for the planners and whatnot. But on the question of the consistency between the TIP and the long-range transportation plan, I scratch my head. By law, the TIP is supposed to be consistent with the financial forecasts of the long-range transportation plan. And I scratch my head about why FDOT is not willing to include that as a checklist item for the TIP. I've said my piece on that many times, and I don't need to say any more.
All right, thank you. Are there any other hands up?
I do not see any other hands raised.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to be moving to item two on the agenda, which is an action item. It's a motion to recommend adoption of amendment number one to the TPA's fiscal year 22-26 TIP. So Jason.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. So today I'm going to present to you the first amendment to the Transportation Improvement Program for fiscal year 2022 through 2026. Being the first amendment action being taken on the Transportation Improvement Program, this is an action item that will require a vote at the end of the presentation and discussion. So to describe what the roll forward is and what this amendment is all about. This is taking funds previously from the previous TIP in fiscal year 2021 for projects that these funds had not been obligated just yet for these particular projects within this amendment, and bringing them forward or rolling forward the funds from fiscal year 21 into fiscal year 2022, which is the first year of the current adopted TIP. And so By taking this action and rolling forward these funds into this current year, we're basically making consistent the transportation improvement program managed by the TPA and making it consistent with the work program for FDOT. So it's required for these two documents to be consistent in funding and in year of funding. And so that is the nature of this action, and the number of projects being impacted by this amendment total about 67 projects with about $39 million in funding that is being carried forward from fiscal year 21 into fiscal year 22. And so there's specific requirements that trigger a TIP amendment, and some of those are listed here. And this is in effect for any amendment that comes before you that requires some kind of change to the TIP through by way of an amendment. And that's triggered by either a project being added or deleted from the TIP document. The cost increases more than 20% and $2 million, or there's a scope change to the project. And that is through a change in the length by a half mile and 20% of the project, or the number of through lanes changes. And as always, with amendments, the only projects that are impacted by amendment are the ones listed in the amendment itself and does not affect any other projects that are listed within the Transportation Improvement Program. Now, the next three slides are just snapshots from the overall 67 projects that are listed as part of the roll forward. These are the projects that have the highest amount that's being rolled forward from 21 to the current TIP 2022. And you'll see the far right, there's three columns. The first one is the current TIP document that was adopted in June. The second column is the amount of funds that's being rolled forward from the previous TIP in 2021 and being rolled into fiscal year 22 of the new TIP. So the final column shows you the addition of the roll forward funds into the current TIP and will show the new amount that will be reflected once this is adopted. And it goes from descending order from the largest amounts being rolled forward to the least amount. And the cutoff for illustration purposes is 500,000 in total funds by phase. So here you just see some of the top ranking projects followed by a few more, which are around 1.5 million. And then it just goes in descending financial order from about 860,000 to about 623,000 in terms of the projects with the highest amount being rolled forward. And so with that, that concludes the presentation on the Amendment 1. And at this point, I'll ask for a motion to recommend adoption of Amendment 1 to the Transportation Improvement Program.
All right, thank you. Are there any comments from any members at this time on the presentation?
I have Michael Fitzpatrick with his hand raised.
Well, first of all, do you need a motion before we discuss?
Either or.
Okay.
Yep.
My question is, if the purposes of this is to sync up our local projects with the state project, how did they get out of sync in the first place?
Okay. Well, all of the projects within the roll forward are FDOT projects. So they're not necessarily local projects. There are local projects within the TIP, but
local
those
funding then.
Yeah. Well, the funding is all federal funding as well. So to be consistent, for FDOT, when we advance to a new year in the new TIP document, there's a TIP document that has to be consistent with FDOT. And so this is the formal action to align the funds as they advance from one year to the next. This is automatically done for FDOT and FHWA, the federal funding source for the funds for the project. But we have to do that kind of manually or formally through an amendment to keep the TIP consistent with STIP. So it is all federal funding, and it's federal funding moving forward. So it's not necessarily a local fund or local projects, but this is just like the follow through to keep the funding consistent with FHWA.
So maybe my memory's fading, which it is, but we do this every year then is what you're saying?
Yes. Okay. Annually, the first change to the TIP document is typically the roll forward report or the FDOT request to advance funds from the previous fiscal year into the current fiscal year for the current TIP, because those funds, as the new TIP is adopted, fiscal year 21 kind of goes away and fiscal year 22 becomes the new current year. And so funds that were unencumbered or unused have to be rolled forward or at least carried forward to the new current year so they can be expended and drawn down for those particular phases for that project.
Understood. I make a motion to approve.
All right. Thank you. I have a motion on the table. Can I have a second?
I'll second the motion.
Okay.
I'll second it. Greg Fagan.
Well, thank you for the support on the motion. So it's going to be a roll call.
Madam Chair, just for the record, I don't have any public comments on this item, but I did have a motion by Michael Fitzpatrick, and I thought my second was Mark Bruner.
You do have Mark Bruner. You also have James here and live here that made the motion or second the motion.
Okay. So if Mark's okay with me just leaving it as is, I'll note that for the minutes.
Yeah,
that's perfect. Fine. That's fine with me.
Okay. So the motion on the floor is to recommend adoption of amendment number one to the TPA's fiscal year 22-26 transportation improvement program as presented. As a reminder, please unmute your microphones by either hitting the button on the base or unmuting on your computer when I call your name. Ramona Bean.
Yes.
James Bonfiglio.
Aye.
Terry Brown.
Yes.
Mark Bruner.
Aye.
Michael Carter. Michael Carter. He'll be marked as absent. Greg Fagan.
Yes.
Michael Fitzpatrick.
Yes.
Mark Forrest.
Yes.
James Garvin.
Yes.
Paco Gill.
Yes.
Vijay Mishra.
Yes.
Brian Rossi.
Yes.
Paula Ryan.
Yes.
Myra Newman.
Yes.
Richard Vazalotti.
Yes.
Cheryl Snyder.
Yes.
Albert Richwagen. Albert Richwagen. He may have stepped away from the computer, so I'll mark him as absent. Wen Deng.
Yes.
It passes unanimously, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. So moving to item 2B is the motion to recommend adoption of the Vision Zero Action Plan update. I believe Jessica Jocelyn is the TPA consultant, Kittleson and Associates, to present on this item.
Yes, now I have my camera working. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you, Chair, for having me here today to present this very important plan. It's near and dear to my heart, and I know a high priority for the TPA. If you move to the next slide, I just wanted to walk through a reminder, or potentially new for some of you, what is Vision Zero? So Vision Zero is a movement to eliminate all traffic fatalities and severe injuries on our transportation network. Vision Zero actually started in 1997 in the country of Sweden. And since they've taken on this mission, they've seen a 50% reduction in fatalities and severe injuries in their country. Since starting this movement in Sweden, the US currently has 49 cities that have adopted this Vision Zero. Some of you may reside in some of those cities or have worked for some of those cities. And also the entire state of Florida under the Department of Transportation has taken on what we call in Florida Target Zero. So this is a very high priority for our entire state and our profession and our community. Next slide. And one thing we really wanted to remind folks, this is about people. In the technical side of things, we can often get wrapped up in crash rates and statistics, but these are lives that are being lost on our roads that we all need to join in and try to eliminate those. So it's not on one person or one agency or one group. We truly all need to work together and say no more, that we're going to commit to do everything we can to not lose family members and friends and lives on our roadways. Next slide. And, you know, the TPA has really been into this since 2016 and probably even before then. But in terms of policy, so moving things into action, we saw that begin in 2016 with your complete streets policy. So creating safe streets or committing to create safe streets for all users. And from the policy in 2017 moved into the design guidelines. So making sure that we had the right tools in place for designing safer streets. In 2018, we all committed to adopting to zero fatalities. I know that was, you know, sometimes a bumpy discussion because some have said, you know, we're never going to get to zero fatalities. But since then, we have committed. We're certainly going to try. In 2019, the original Vision Zero Action Plan was adopted by the TPA, where we set forth, again, the vision and commitment to try to achieve and move towards zero fatalities and severe injuries. And then I have the honor today to be presenting the update to show how the numbers are looking through 2020 and some new actions that the TPA is presenting to you today to move forward and get commitment on. Next slide. So we wanted to pause and just share the key principles that go into Vision Zero. Just as the solution is not one group of people, it's also just not one piece of data or information that goes into the solutions or the tools to get us towards Vision Zero. So as you can see, there are 9 differing components that go into the principles behind the Vision Zero, ranging from political commitment all the way to data and transparency. I did want to highlight the upper right on equity. Equity is extremely important to the Vision Zero process, making sure that all human beings, no matter their age, their background, where they live, how they travel, are equally valued and equally protected and provided facilities on our transportation system. Next slide. So diving into the data, unfortunately, I am reporting that in 2020, we did see the highest number of deaths on our transportation system over the past 5 years. You will see dips, as you can see, from 2016 to 2020, where we did see a decrease in fatalities. But unfortunately, that number did increase in 2020. Over the past 5 years, 887 lives have been lost on our roadways. 5,395 people, all different ages and backgrounds, had severe injuries on our transportation system. And, you know, Palm Beach County, as you know, either being residents or working there, it's a large area that we need to work on creating a safer system for. And it's about 2,000 square miles. We are approaching 1.5 million people. So we have a lot of work to do to reach our community. And we also need to consider the various age ranges in our community. Almost 1 in 4 of the residents of Palm Beach County are 65 years and older. And that's just one example of we need to be thoughtful in how we tackle the safety issues on our roadway so that we can accommodate the 65 and older population and also keeping in mind younger populations and everyone in between. Next slide. So looking at what we call the high injury network. So the high injury network was identified really through a formula. In all honesty though, Vision Zero is for all roadways to be safe and trying to achieve zero fatalities and serious injuries. But we do like to, on the engineering and planning side, at least start where the need is the greatest. And that is what we are calling the high injury network, where we saw the most amount of fatalities and severe injury crashes occurring. So when looking at the high injury network, most at risk, and this is common throughout the country, are your older adults, your pedestrian and cyclists, and also your traditionally underserved communities. Looking at our data, we also found in Palm Beach County over the past 5 years, critical crash factors occurred on Fridays and weekends and during the nighttime from 7 to 10 p.m. And we have a sample of worst streets in Palm Beach County. This list certainly doesn't stop at three, but the three samples that we pulled from the data set to share with you are Glades Road, Boynton Beach Boulevard, and Okeechobee Boulevard. What's important to share with you is the trend is the larger, wider facilities with fast speeds occurring on them tended to float to the top in terms of facilities that really have the greatest need for improving safety. And often that occurs just simply from the amount of people traveling on them. You're going to have greater exposure to potential crashes, but it's still just as important. Even if the exposure is high, we still want to get to zero fatalities and injuries. Next slide. So it was very important in this update that the Vision Zero align with your strategic plan. I know a lot of thought goes into the TPA's strategic plan and commitment across all of the committees and the board. So first was implementing and updating the Vision Zero action plan. So I applaud you all for having that done in 2019 and the update this year. Also in the strategic plan focused on safety was having your interactive comment map on your website, which does collect quite a bit of input where folks can go in and make comments on safety. And then the TPA has the ability to follow up and see where improvements can be made. Your pedestrian and bicycle safety field reviews have been best practices, if I can say, and have really resulted in positive feedback and solutions to make our streets safer for the pedestrian and bicyclists. Another reminder in your strategic plan in how you score your transportation, your local initiatives and your transportation alternatives program projects, safety is a component of that scoring process and important. Also, District 4 is working on an application process for safety. So that's an important element of the strategic plan. And then lastly, modifying your committee and other committees to ensure that safety representation is there. So there's a really nice alignment with Vision Zero with your strategic plan. And moving to the next slide. So now I'm going to walk through kind of the meat of this presentation, and those are the new actions that the TPA is looking for your feedback on. I'm going to go through three different categories. The first one being policy actions. There are 12 actions in total across the three categories I'm going to read through. And I don't like to read slides when I'm presenting, but in this case, I think it's pretty important to walk through each of these with you. So under policy actions, there are five, as you can see here. So the first is to produce a Vision Zero annual report and proactively seek feedback and research latest Vision Zero best practices. So what's measured gets mattered type of approach here. Include safety changes in TPA legislation and policy positions is another action. Identify target speeds for high crash corridors based on context classification and safety. I know that has a lot of planner jargon in there, but you're going to be hearing a presentation on target speed and what the Department of Transportation is doing there. So we're looking forward to partner with them. Collaborate with partners to create a consistent process for displaying the safety analysis included in the TIP projects. So this is important that at a policy level, we are making sure safety analysis is included in all the projects we do so that you as a committee and your board can make decisions based on that information. And then the last one on policy actions, very important, is working with the school district of Palm Beach County to require safe walking, biking, and driving curriculum. So those are the five for policy. And then moving to the next category, funding actions. We have two for this category. The first is work with signal maintaining agencies to make signalized intersection crossings more pedestrian friendly. And then the other one of the two is evaluate safety aspects of TPA funded projects 1 year after construction completion. So again, we want to make sure that as a TPA, we're collecting before after data, so we can continue to help increase the knowledge that goes into our decision-making process. And then the last category, that I'll be walking through is the culture actions that the TPA has identified. So we have five here. The first is to provide reviews of fatal pedestrian and bicycle crash reports, including observations and potential actions. The second is to collaborate with roadway owners, such as the county or the state and the cities, to maintain a detailed data inventory to provide more effective analysis of complete streets opportunities. The third is to implement a Vision Zero media and public education campaign. I know Melissa at the TPA has already begun that effort with Cassidy and her team. The fourth is to host an annual Vision Zero workshop for local communities and agencies. The theme here is really the TPA can't do this on their own, of course, that we want to partner with the local agencies and just expand from there so we can each get the word out and provide our thoughts and education and ideas into making our streets safer. And the last one, for the culture actions, is to participate in a Vision Zero safety event, as well as other local transportation safety events, and encourage those events to be held in those traditionally underserved communities that I noted are most at risk. So that, in summary, are the 12 actions that are part of this Vision Zero update. So with that, I am done with the presentation on Vision Zero, and I'm happy to answer any questions, take any feedback from the committee.
All right. Are there any comments at this time from the general public?
I did not receive any comments.
Okay. How about any comments or raise hand function from committee members?
I have Paula followed by Myron so far.
And then James. So can we go in that order, Paula, Myron, and then James?
Yes, thank you. I just want to compliment you on your report and the presentation. I thought it was extremely comprehensive. And I like that every time we see this, it's growing more and more. And I really look forward to seeing funds be put into projects or funds awarded to projects that take these policy and data into consideration. And I am looking forward to increase infrastructure dollars down to Palm Beach County. So I just want to say thank you to the TPA and to you, Jessica, because it keeps it it keeps it in the forefront of everybody's thinking, and it's right in line with everything else that's going on. So thank you for the report.
Thank you, Paula. I really appreciate your feedback, and I'm glad we have a strong partner in you to push this forward.
All right, thank you. Myron?
I too thought the report was very well done. My only disappointment is that none of the actions have any focus on enforcement of existing traffic laws. And as a driver, I see violations of the law of traffic rules all the time. That in some of the intersections that are marked on your map as dangerous intersections. And in particular, the bicycling community seems to have total disregard for traffic laws. And I wonder whether any aspect of enforcement should creep into the Vision Zero plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Myron. That's an excellent point you made. I am working closely with Andrew and connecting with law enforcement to see if there's more opportunity to pull that stakeholder group in. And we are exploring the idea of bringing law enforcement more as a presence onto the TPA committees. So we're hopeful that that partnership will move forward and we can make some progress there.
Yeah. Thank you. And last comment, James.
Hello. Thank you very much for that report. It's very nicely done, very detailed, and I do appreciate it. but is part of their plan, you've identified internal benchmarks and internal things to do to progress towards Vision Zero. But based off of 5 years of varying fatality and injury statistics, are there any other hard metrics that we can look at and track towards progress aside from just, you know, reduction in fatalities and injuries?
Yeah, that's a hard question. I know in the last talking to the TAC, even discussing land use choices and decisions and how we develop our community, it's just a very complicated, multi-layered world in terms of how we make our streets safer. So we are trying to identify a comprehensive and diverse set of metrics for which we can measure. One of the struggles we run into is having these kind of outside the box metrics or things outside transportation crash information is that the data is not consistent or readily available across all of our communities, which makes it hard to use it in our decision making. But certainly if this committee has any ideas on additional metrics, we are happy to research and explore that. And, you know, even if we put it in now, as this is something we want to measure, even if we can't today, that certainly is something we're considering and happy to incorporate. So, James, I don't know if anything comes to mind specifically, but we're there with you, understanding it's not that simple.
No, I don't expect it to be simple. But like I said, I know I want to make sure that if those efforts being put towards a plan, we can document successes when they happen. So identifying those when possible is, aside from just fatality injury, which is very important, would be useful. So,
yeah. And one thing that comes to mind, Chair, if you don't mind me just adding in the before after action item that is in the action plan, we're hopeful that that will bring us some momentum in individual locations that we'll be able to see a positive change in trend from a safety perspective. So that one thing comes to mind that we can report back as projects are implemented and ideally see a trend in the right direction.
Right, this is Myra Newman. I have my hand raised, and to make exactly that point, this committee was very active a couple of years ago in encouraging incorporating scoring for safety into the process in which one decides whether projects get funding or not. And we talked about before and after studies then. I have to tell you, I think that's great. We should do that. As an engineer, I think 1 year before and 1 year after, not sufficient amount of data to really understand whether improvements in intersections have really, for example, have affected safety. And one needs to collect more data than that, you know, typically 5 years before and 5 years after. Would and elsewhere in the transportation field, for example, when signalized intersections are converted into roundabouts, typically they compare 5 years before and 5 years after, because 1 year's data can be very episodic.
Yeah, Myron, actually the technical committee this morning also recommended 5 years. So I think I don't want to put words in Andrew's mouth, but I suspect we're going to be expanding that. So excellent point.
All right. Thank you so much. Are there any other member comments on this item at this time? Oh, Ramona.
Jessica, thank you again for the presentation. And I'm glad you went through the 12 different things. I noticed that one of them was referring to the target speeds, and adding on to what Myron was just saying about studying the data, because correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm sure Target Zero folks that have been working on this found that last year there's so much speeding, and that's just a difficult metric there, because, you know, folks were really stressed out with pandemic ongoing and whatnot. So I worry about feeling that we're not succeeding in some areas with some of these visions here. So anyway, I support it, but I just want to say thank you so much for presenting this, and that we're looking at particularly on the data and the metrics we're bringing into measure, you know, how we can help avoid more of these fatalities and such. Thanks.
All right. Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Ramona.
Are there any other member comments? Thank you so much, Jess. This is definitely a very, very thought through report. I agree with Myron in reference to enforcement. I do think that for you can't engineer, by the time that we wait for physical changes to happen in a capital perspective, it'll take too long, right? So the immediate result is really looking at the data that you have and enforcing at the right time in the afternoon or in the weekend. And that's where, and it's very difficult for the TPA to really set that goal without having to work with local law enforcement. And of course, I'm sure that the sheriffs or even local city police departments will be on board of this and knowing that these type of enforcement works, because there's no way that you can diversify how much time and effort the police department can put into traffic enforcing. But you have good data, you know where the high crash corridors are at, and you know what time of day that those frequency of the crashes are happening. And I think that's where you can help, the data that you produce can really help cities. The other thing is, I think adopting a Vision Zero policy really sets a framework for the TPA, but also encouraging local government and local agencies within Palm Beach County to adopt their own policy. So every community is accountable for its network, because it's a system and we all need to work together. And then lastly, I like your comment about traffic signal. I do have to make a comment on that. Looking at what San Francisco did a few years ago, and they looked at the type of crashes that they were having at their intersection, and they've made some really tough choices by eliminating left-hand turns, in essence, to eliminate those type of conflict and turning movements. I know that part of the study is to take a deeper dive into looking at traffic signals and making it more pedestrian friendly. And so I think that's the right direction. And that's as far as like making operational changes, adding more leading pedestrian interval, whatever that may take. I think those little changes can happen very, very quickly that will yield the right result. So thank you so much for your presentation.
Yeah, thank you. I'm taking notes from everyone, and I look forward to bringing all this feedback back to the group and finalizing this in a collaborative way. Thank you.
Yeah, great. So James, one more comment.
One more thought, sorry, real quick. But one of the things I'm looking through the action plan, and perhaps it would be beneficial to do macro examinations. Perhaps there's an intersection that's been historically bad that was then invested into, and then we can then contrast that with a pro. Because when you're looking at these statistics, you're counting on a county level. But if we get more macro with it and really target, like let's say the intersection of Okeechobee and Job, what improvements were done there over the years? Can we track that to show the impact of the Vision Zero plan?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea, because you have your three highest crash corridor. It's probably Okeechobee and Military, if I have to make a guess. Because you've identified three corridor, let's pick three intersection out of that corridor and let's track it as a group for us throughout this upcoming year to see how we can help make those changes.
No, I definitely think that if we want to track the successes and find them, right, looking at specific spots might be a good way of doing so versus a countywide level.
Right. Perfect. Thank you so much.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
You've been talking, or the panel has been talking, about more enforcement, law enforcement of the traffic laws. And I wonder if we actually have jurisdiction to make recommendations to law enforcement to enforce the laws, because we encompass so many jurisdictions. We have several municipalities, we have the sheriff's office. They all have their own agendas with respect to their own traffic laws that they enforce within their municipality. So do we have that kind of jurisdiction to make a recommendation that, Boca Raton, for example, enforces the traffic laws around the Glades Road intersection that causes the most fatalities, for example. Could we even do that? And would they listen to us?
I can speak from experience because working with the city of West Palm Beach, their police department, they when the city adopted a Vision Zero policy, the police department was part of the team, very integral part of the team. I don't think this this group, the citizen advisory, although we represent the entire county, I do think that it's important for us to part of the action plan is to direct it in a way that staff works with the local municipal government and work with the local as part of collaboration or coordination efforts. Not necessarily, we can't dictate, you know, but if there's good data, that'll help them with their target enforcement.
Well, I went through the Vision Zero Action Plan, and I don't recall seeing anything in there about liaising with local law enforcement with respect to traffic law enforcement. So that's why I make that question. It's not even in there.
Yeah.
At least I don't recall seeing anything in there about coordinating with local law enforcement and the individual municipalities within our jurisdiction to work with them on more and effective traffic enforcement. And you know, each individual municipality has their own agenda with respect to traffic enforcement. Most of your municipalities, for example, the traffic laws, they don't want to enforce specifically against their own residents, which usually are the biggest speeders. They're the biggest people, the biggest number of people that blow through stop signs, that blow through traffic lights. It's your local people going back and forth from home to work. Yeah. Back again.
Yeah,
and so there's a reluctance on municipalities from enforcing enforcing traffic, because a lot of times you're going to be snaring your own residents.
Understood. So two things. One is, I'm sure Andrew and the TPA team can get into details of the action plan and address your concern. The other aspect of it is that from the liaison report, there is item number 7 is the high visibility enforcement grant. So there's funding available for law enforcement to really tackle this and see how they can supplement their staff time to even to do target enforcement. But I'm going to defer to Andrew to answer your comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Andrew Euler, Deputy Director of Program Development. I was about to say what you were about to say, actually. When it comes to enforcement, well, going back to this action plan, we're trying to gear the action plan specifically towards actions that the TPA can do as a body and the staff can do in their time to move the needle towards Vision Zero. And I think one of the toughest ones is enforcement and what we can actually do as a TPA. Because as you mentioned, there are a lot of different jurisdictions out there with their own law enforcement. And the way they tackle that right now is when it comes to enforcing these issues, those high visibility enforcement grants, those are ones from FDOT. And they actually do a really data-driven approach to those. So if it's a specific type of issue at specific locations and actually specific times of days, they actually work with, and if you're a top location in the state or in the district, you actually can get those grants and you'll work directly to have those law enforcement officers go out there and do more enforcement at those specific times. So they're really leading that effort to get more funding out there for law enforcement to do that enforcement portion.
That's I think the biggest obstacle is if you're going to tell, for example, West Palm Beach or Boca Raton, hey, you need more officers enforcing traffic at this intersection or that intersection, you're fighting into the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And where's the money going to come from for the extra officers, the extra overtime for doing that?
Yes, exactly. And I think where we can, our approach to this is we can hopefully provide more resources to them if they need them. So it looks like they're doing a pretty good job of getting that data from the state when it comes to knowing those locations, and the law enforcement already knows those high crash locations in the first place. The other things you'll see in the plan might be geared more towards policy considerations at the state level. So I think in our first category for policy, we have one about advocating for state law changes when it comes to certain types of automated speed enforcement, and some other ones related to these issues with enforcement. So that's where sort of we have our ability to like push together as a whole from a policy perspective and try to force that issue. But when it comes to evaluation or the local level and our policing of this, it's really, can we provide some types of resources for law enforcement is really where I think our power is as a TPA. But it's a very important issue, and you're all correct about enforcement being a big concern. But we didn't put everything in the report that isn't in our purview as much.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right. If there are any and no more discussion, can I have a motion on the adoption of the Vision Zero Action Plan update?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to make a motion.
Okay, Paula, can I have a second?
Terry Brown.
Okay. So, Margie, at this time, can you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. So just to reiterate, the motion on the floor is to recommend adoption of the Vision Zero Action Plan update. I will note that it will include the items that were addressed today and that were brought up in discussion, and that my staff will follow up on specific requests on how they can get incorporated. So please remember to unmute your microphones either by hitting the button on the base or on your computer. And say yes or no or yay or nay when I call your name. Ramona Bean?
Yes.
James Bonfiglio?
Aye.
Terry Brown?
Yes.
Mark Bruner?
Yes.
Michael Carter? I don't believe he's joined us, so I'll mark him as absent. Greg Fagan?
Yes.
Michael Fitzpatrick?
Yes.
Mark Forrest?
Yes.
James Garvin?
Yes.
Akko Gill?
Yes.
BJ Mishra?
Yes.
Ryan Rossi?
Yes.
Paula Ryan?
Yes.
Myra Newman?
Yes.
Richard Vasilotti?
Yes.
Cheryl Snyder?
Yes.
Albert Richwagen?
Yes.
Wen Deng?
Yes.
It passes unanimously, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you so much. Moving on to item three. This is an information item on the FDOT design manual to implement target speeds. At this time, I'd like to invite Dwayne Carver to do this presentation. Or is it Scott Peterson?
It's Dwayne and Scott. It's the Dwayne and Scott show today.
Great.
I think Scott's here. There he is. All right, great. Good afternoon. Thank you for having us. It's very interesting to hear your previous conversation about Target Zero and Vision Zero. Target Zero is FDOT's flavor of the Vision Zero approach, and this is actually a part of that. So what I'm going to tell you about today is a roadway design bulletin, RDB. We like our acronyms at DOT. It is a bulletin that updates our design manual. The FDOT design manual is kind of the rule book, if you will, for how we design the state roadway system. And what this bulletin does is add a new element to that called target speed. And I'll tell you a little bit about it. And then Scott's going to tell you more specifically how District 4 will be using this information. And there we go. This is actually also brought to you by the Vital Few. As a part of Target Zero, Secretary Tebow has instituted a series of Vital Few teams to work on things that are basically kind of narrowly focused on the things that are going to make the biggest difference to us for safety. And in these three specific areas, bike, ped, intersection, and lane departure safety, these are all areas that the department or that the state of Florida really has a noted problem with. And so we are trying to improve in all these areas. And it turns out that managing the speeds on our roadways is going to be an effective way to help all of these safety issues. So what this design bulletin does, if you look at this chart that's on the right-hand side of the screen here, this is showing you our context classifications, which I hope you're familiar with those. It's how Florida DOT looks at the context of where our roadways are found, and that helps us make design decisions about it. If you look at the center column here, it's a range of design speeds. And What the design speed does is it tells you what kinds of things you can put along the roadway, how far things have to be set back, or how close you can build them. And that then affects what kinds of facilities can go there. A whole bunch of things is determined by that design speed. And when we put these design speed ranges in place, we'd never had design speeds this low before on the state highway system. And so those ranges are there to kind of account for the fact that we already have a lot of existing roads that are kind of, maybe faster or slower. But it doesn't really, we've not really given folks a whole lot of guidance about where to fall within that design speed range and how you might get there. And so that's where this target speed idea is coming up from. So the target speed is the desired operating speed that you would have when you finished your project. And so what the bulletin does is it recognizes that if we're going to set a speed like that, it's got to be an interdisciplinary approach. A lot of times what we found is that the city planners and the context classification folks who spend a lot of time looking at this information, they have a pretty good idea what a target speed might need to be there. That has got to be relayed to the other folks on the team, and then they can talk about it. And it turned out that nobody really understood how we're supposed to pay for it. And so the work program folks have to get involved as well. So it's an interdisciplinary team that helps us set that. And it requires that you have a target speed, any place where you have a design speed. Not all projects require a design speed, but if you do have one, you've got to use a target speed first to help you set that design speed, again, picking it from within this range here. It provides a little bit of guidance on how those target speeds should be selected within the FDM. That guidance will be there. And also we have a context classification guide that will have additional guidance on it, but that's something that we'll just have to do training and keep providing materials on that. And the bulletin recognizes the district as continues to be actually the final decision maker on the design speed for the project. So it's a state road and we're responsible for it. And so the decision to what that design speed will always be made by the district in the end. I wanted to share with you a little bit to kind of illustrate the complexity of this so it didn't look like you just kind of pull a lever and a target speed, you know, pops out the back end of the thing. There's a lot that kind of has to go into this. And so the process that we go through here, and this it's a little different if you have a project with a planning phase, like a PD&E project. A lot of this target speed work and discussion might be done as part of PD&E, but a lot of our projects don't go through that phase. They may be a 3R project, for instance. And wherever it is, at some point, however the project starts, it gets to a point where you've done your context classification review, you've done your planning phase, and you've had some discussions about what might be a reasonable target speed on that particular project. So then there's another step you have to go through where you set the design controls for the project so that you can then go out and build it. And that's where you have a lot of discussion about, well, you know, we think the target speed would be great if we could reach this target speed. What do we think we could actually build and design? And this is when you start looking at what the options might be to help you affect that target speed. And there's another step when you maybe have some ideas about how we might be able to achieve a particular speed, got to go through scoping and budget and see what we can actually afford to build on that project. It may just require something that we just don't have the money to do right now. Can we go find that money somewhere else? Can somebody else help us pay for it? Those things have all got to be worked out so we can get a scope and budget to move ahead with. Once all that's done, that it can go into work program, it can get its allocation that it needs for that, then we can design the thing and make sure that it's got all the pieces that we need based on the money that we had to spend on it. Then we'll build it and then we'll monitor it and see how well it works. So that's the idea behind this target speed process. We start with an idea what the target speed would be. We have a lot of discussion about what we could actually design and build on that. And then we agree on what the final target speed and design speed are going to be, and we roll ahead with the project at that point. So just to kind of recap, so we start by looking at the context classification that gives us the range of speeds. And then the target speed determines what design speed we want to use for a particular project. FDM 202, that's another chapter in the FDOT design manual, has a lot of tools in there for help us achieve a target speed, but it doesn't have any money in it. It just tells you what the tools are. So you got to go find that money to use those tools and figure out which ones you can afford on your project. And looking at all those things together helps you figure out what your final target speed and design speed would be. Looking at this balance of all the things you need with the context classification, the project needs, and our available resources. And then the district has to make that final decision. Now, how do the locals fit into this? Well, at the very beginning of that process I was telling you about, one of the things that the district will be looking at to try to see what the target speed, you know, perhaps should be is, what would the locals like it to be? What is your land use patterns telling us about what how you're going to be developing in the future? And that will affect the speed that we're going to have. A lot of other things go into that. You know, is there transit there? Are there any safety issues there already? A lot of these things will go into that decision. and what your local vision is certainly a part of that as well. And we've just seen, you know, the Safe Streets plan that you guys are talking about now, and the previous discussion that you just had shows that you're committed and concerned about safety on your roadways. That helps us a lot in trying to decide how far we can push on these things. So I'm going to give Scott now a chance to talk more about how the district actually will be implementing this in District 4. So Scott, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, so Dwayne touched on a lot of these things. I'll just emphasize some of them. This is obviously something that's ideally decided early because it could affect the scope of the project. If you want to start doing lane narrowing or medians or landscaping, we need to know those scope items. So this is going to be done hopefully around the time of programming or very early. That is when someone from the department should be reaching out to the locals and getting some input on these types of things. Again, it is a multidisciplinary decision. And it's not to say a decision that was made 5 years in advance of the design starting, can never be reconsidered. You know, once a design team is on board and working on it, I'm quite sure that decision will be confirmed. But it will be used originally to help set the original scope. So the second bullet, oh, I'm sorry, can you back up one?
Sorry.
The second bullet there acknowledges we got a whole bunch of projects that are past programming and are already in design that are sort of past the phase. And since this bulletin is to be implemented immediately for all projects that are early in the design phase, we will have the design teams make recommendations to the multidisciplinary team in the department. Considering those factors, I'm getting ready to talk about on the next slide. So we're not going to overlook those. We're going to go back and retroactively do target speed on ones that may have already started design. Okay, next slide. So as Dwayne mentioned, there's a lot of factors that go into it. Yeah, the second bullet there is local input. That's, I'm sure, the one you guys are very interested in. That is one of the factors, an important factor. But on this slide, I want to emphasize that it is not the goal of the department just to go lower the speed on every single road because slower is safer. We want to make the right decision for the right project. And this target speed gives us the tools to do that. So we want to look at all of these things on here and make the right decision. You know, I've been a design engineer at DOT for close to 30 years. And for close to 30 years, the way you figured out the design speed was whatever the last person used, that was probably right. We'll just do that again. And if the locals ever wanted to change it, or if anybody wanted to change it, it could be quite arduous process to try to get that changed. We're trying to make that a little easier. We're trying to be a little more proactive in accomplishing safety, local vision, multimodal factors, those types of things. So there's a range of factors, and local input will be important. But I'm sure the locals would have opinions on all these other things too. It'll be the locals that tell us their future vision for the corridor or the future development plans. Locals tend to know the accident history and the safety, the flooding sometimes better than the department does. So your input will be very important. Next slide. And so once we've made the decision to have a lower target speed, then the question I'm going to ask all the design teams is, okay, what are you going to do about it? What techniques are you going to do to try to reduce speeds here if they're not already at that target speed? So this bullet list here is a very limited list. There's a much of techniques that can be used to reduce speed. There's a much more complete list on the references I give there to the right on the slide. And again, this goes, and the other big point I want to make is, as Dwayne mentioned, but I'll just step on that point a little more. This is not free reign to expand the scope of every project into a lane repurposing, let's slow the speed down. I mean, if it is a triple R project and we can restripe to get narrower lanes and a wider bike lane, by all means, we want to do that. But it doesn't mean we have the budget on every project to rebuild curbs and move drainage and, put up decorative lighting and landscaping. Though that's going to be a project by project decision based on funding. And we want to accomplish what we can within the reasonable limitations of how the project was scoped originally. And with that, we look forward to working with you and all the locals on getting this implemented on our projects.
All right, thank you. Margie, are there any public comments on this item at this time?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. I believe Ramona has her hands up.
I just have a question, if that's all right.
Absolutely.
Dwayne, Scott, thank you for the presentation. Just for institutional knowledge, especially Scott, since you've spent 30 years in this business, in Florida, have we ever looked at having speed limit signs that change? I've just noticed traveling around the country, there are certain states where, like on the highways and their interstates, at certain times of the day, they change the speed limit. So let's say they'd go from a 65 down to 55, depending on the flow of traffic or even the environmental conditions. Have we ever looked at that in our state or at FDOT?
I am not familiar. Dwayne, who I appreciate your acknowledgement of my 30 years, but Dwayne's probably been doing this just as long as me, as a more of a statewide perspective. Dwayne, are you familiar with any instances like that?
Not specifically. I know the technology that you're talking about, and there are some really neat ones out there. And traffic engineering office at the department is looking into a whole range of things like that, including leading pedestrian intervals and things like this that we haven't normally done. So that is something to consider. I know we've seen the different day and night speed limits. A lot of times that's done with a sign. And what you're talking about is kind of a similar thing. You could also, the streetlights are getting smarter now. They can kind of detect how fast the traffic is moving. It's theoretically possible to use the streetlights to the traffic signals to slow the traffic down based on how folks are behaving on the roadway. I don't know that to my knowledge, we've not done yet in Florida, but it is something that we're considering. So all those things are on the table. Anything that would help.
Thanks.
Yeah. All right. Are there any other members that have a comment on this item?
I have Paula, and then I did have Terry. Oh, I have Paula and Terry.
Okay, Paula and Terry. Paula?
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I only have a quick question, which was part of the intro to the discussion. And that was that this is a bulletin, and the bulletin is part of more an online access so that these manuals can update and change more frequently. Is that what I'm hearing, that FDOT has moved to that level of technological engagement so that this stuff can happen in real time?
The bulletin is posted online and you can go online and find it. We don't change the document text itself once it's posted, partly because a lot of these documents are referred to in contracts and things like that. And so we kind of freeze them at a certain level. And if we make changes to it, then that's documented in a bulletin and you would go find that bulletin. So technically, if you're doing something, you would want to look at the FDM and you probably want to go check the bulletins page too and see if there's any bulletins that might affect what you're working on. When we release the FDM in 2022, it gets updated every year, then this bulletin language will be incorporated in it. And so it'll be just a part and parcel of the document. Right now it's listed as a separate document as the bulletin. And that's the way that we handle the bulletins for our mid-year changes.
So the projects that I think, Dwayne, I don't know whether it was you or Scott that referenced that would be looked at, that they're early enough, you know, the already funded projects or projects that are in the pipeline, then this application would be incorporated into that
project. Yeah, Dwayne, can I answer that?
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
So with every bulletin, as Dwayne mentioned, the manual doesn't actually get updated continuously. It happens at certain intervals, but bulletins get issued fairly frequently. And every bulletin has an implementation strategy given to us. If it's really not that big a change and not that important, they might say all projects beginning in 2022. This particular bulletin said beginning effective immediately for all projects prior to phase about 30% plans. So it was effective immediately. I've seen safety things that affected barrier wall, guardrail. They said, I don't care if you're in construction, you will go and retroactively, you know, change those contracts to update this. But to answer your question, yes, this will be done for projects that are relatively early in the design process.
Thank you, Paula. I believe Terry has the next comment.
Yes, I know this might sound a bit outrageous, but you list the top speed in the state of Florida at 70. Is that in statute or is that just federal policy, or where did the 70 come from? I'm suggesting that since everybody goes above 70, or a lot of people go above 70, that you have dedicated separate lanes where it could be 75. And you'd be moving a lot more traffic, make them pay, and you would keep the other lanes staggered down until you get all the way over on the right-hand side. Has anyone ever considered that? Similar to the comment regarding the signal and changing the speed if the traffic gets too dangerous. but you could actually have lanes where they're traveling 75 legally, since they're doing 90 anyway. That's a joke, but I mean, you see them go by you in a zip. Has that ever been considered on highways, turnpikes, interstates?
It comes up from time to time, and the standards that we use are based on the AASHTO standards, which is they're not standards, but the AASHTO guidance from the AASHTO Green Book, which is the national policy guidance, and it's based on that. There are states out west that have higher speed limits, and for some of their roadways that travel very long sections, and it can feel like even at 70, you're just crawling along. It's never something that's gotten a whole lot of traction here in Florida. We really don't have, it may seem like we do, but we really don't have the huge unbroken stretches that at the level that they a lot of times do out west. And it's just never something that's had a whole lot of traction to get moving, to be honest with you. It does come up from time to time. But so far, the consensus has usually been that we're okay with the speeds that we've got. 70 is a design speed that's pretty well understood. There's a lot of FHWA and other research and things out there that help us understand, you know, how traffic behaves, how vehicles behave at that speed, and how to design the road for that. So it has come up before, but to my knowledge, it's never really received a whole lot of traction. So, yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Terry. Is there anybody, does anybody else have their hands up that you see? Margie?
Sorry, I was having problems unmuting. No, I do not see any more hands raised.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I do have one comment or a question in general is I'm really excited that FDOT is implementing target speed. We know that the majority of like severe crashes are happening on urban arterials. Are there any consideration to prioritize? Because Scott, you said, yes, there's not enough funding for everything, right? And of course we understand, but as a citizen advisory committee, is there like opportunities for us to advise that maybe we should prioritize additional funding for urban arterials because those are the roads that we see the most severe crashes outside of, you know, when, so that it gives you the opportunity for you to implement some of these strategies when you go in to do, for example, a triple R project?
I think the answer to your question is yes, there is an opportunity, but I would put it in different words than you. So DOT does not have a program specifically designed to go implement target speeds. We're not looking for places to go reduce speeds. As triple R's come up, we will consider the speeds. However, if the TPA were to say, you know, there's a couple corridors here we really feel should be reduced, and, you know, you'll have some preliminary discussions with DOT, and we say, yeah, that's going to take, you know, a bit of reconstruction, though, you know, moving curbs and drainage, then you might say, okay, we'll prioritize that project, just like you may for a shared use path, you know, or if it's a more substantial construction and budget that's above and beyond our triple R, or maybe there's not even a triple R program. I think the TPA could prioritize a project to accomplish that goal.
Yeah, because I think it's a healthy conversation that we just had on the last item that we voted on to support Vision Zero, especially in this area. So, and we've already identified three high crash corridor in Palm Beach County. And ultimately, if those projects end up Glades or Okeechobee that come up in a triple R project, and I'm looking at you, Andrew, if that's something that as an advisory committee that we could, you know, figure out if there's some ways to provide FDOT with the tools for them to implement these strategies.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. That's a very good point. We actually put in our action plan, one of the action to identify corridors and set target speeds. And what we saw actually from, I think it was Hillsborough County or might've been Ford Pinellas, but I believe it was Hillsborough. They actually looked at all of their corridors and they looked at those contents classifications, and those contents classifications have speed ranges. And so they compared what those rate, the current speeds out there versus what the contents classification speed ranges were. And they identified ones where there's like large variances in those. And so they targeted those corridors first. So they approached it from a safety perspective of like high crash corridors. And then they also looked at ones where maybe the speed limit's a little bit too high for the contents classification. And so that was a good place to start. And I think we can do the same here at the TPA where we look at those high injury network corridors and then see where there might be places where it's already a high speed at the higher level of the contest classification that's out there.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
If I could just add one point, Andrew, I just want there to be no misunderstanding and complete candor. Andrew mentioned the TPA might look and set some target speeds. It won't be the TPA setting the target speeds. They will recommend that will be a very important piece of information that we consider, but at the end of the day, it's going to be a department decision in collaboration with our partners.
I fully understand. FDOT will have the final say, but this board will be looking forward to those TIP amendments, right? thank you so much.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Yes. I do have Michael Fitzpatrick and Paula Ryan with their hands raised.
I apologize. He's not
no.
Here.
My question is not related to this. It's an agenda question, which doesn't need to be right now, but before it, well, basically, I noticed that I misread it and member comments have already come and gone. It would be possible to make a comment before adjournment.
If it's related to this item,
not this item, that's
not this item.
Doesn't have to be now. I said before adjournment.
Sure, absolutely. Okay. I think because we had members comment at the beginning, what we can do is, we can have open it up for discussion at the administrative item.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Seeing no more comments.
And I had Paula with her hand raised as well.
Again, I apologize. I don't see everybody's. Paula?
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to say, Scott, I'm glad you jumped in and said what you said, that, you know, FDOT has the final decision, because I think it's important when local are talking, you know, local funders are talking to the constituents, and the constituents are screaming at you and telling you that, you know, they want this speed limit or that speed limit. And we can recommend all day long, but ultimately it will be your decision. So as part of the sort of get out the information to the public, you know, I think that they need to understand that we're going to advocate as hard as we can, but it's you guys that make the final call.
If I could jump in on that, I think, to me, the term target speed is a useful one to use in that condition, because when you say you want this speed limit or that speed limit, you've just set in motion a whole chain of engineering things that are kind of complex, and that could give you an answer much different than you think you're going to get when you go do that speed study. When you say target speed, you know, the department will pick the target speed for the project that we need, but that doesn't restrict anyone from going out and looking at a roadway and saying, I think it would be great if this roadway was operating at this particular speed. That's your target speed. And because when you come in and talk about changing a speed limit, you've just gotten, you know, you've drifted into engineering world, but you can talk about a target speed and say the desired operating speed on this roadway for it to work the way our community wants to work would be this. And we'll take that as one piece of many pieces of information that will go into the final target speed decision that Scott's group will be making. But to me, that's a more useful thing to say than to say we want a speed limit or whatever, unless you're a traffic operations engineer. To come in and tell me what a speed limit should be is going to be hard for me to really know if you know what you're talking about. But you can say target speed. Anybody could say, oh, I think it should be running this fast. It's just one bit of data. The department will make the final decision. But to me, that's really conveying more what the community wants to see anyway. Than the same what the speed limit is. So that's just my thoughts on it.
Yes, thank you. It is a collaborative, and it really needs to be, you know, engaged in that process. So thank you very much for the presentation.
Sure. James?
Yeah, I have a question. Going back to the 1970s, which I guess shows you how old I am, my recollection is that when we had OPEC do the embargo, federal government came in and mandated you either reduce speed limits to 55 and below, or you don't get any federal funding, and which obviously led to a great reduction in gasoline consumption and also coincidentally a great reduction in traffic fatalities and crashes on the interstate system. My question is, in light of where we're going with our new federal highway bills that's coming out, and I guess there's going to be a big transportation bill that's going to come out through reconciliation, do you see the federal government mandating reduced speed limits in each state in order, as a condition of getting funding, in order to reduce the footprint for individual automobiles traveling through the interstate?
I have absolutely no opinion about that. I really could not tell you. Wouldn't even begin to guess what the federal government might do next with their highway policy. So we're looking forward to getting some stimulus money to build some much needed safety and other projects in the state of Florida. But as far as that level of policy that you're discussing, I really couldn't. I'd really have no idea. I wouldn't even know where to start. So I do vaguely remember way back then in the 70s when that happened. But I really have no way to know what that might be.
All right.
Scott might know, but I don't.
No, that is way above my pay grade.
Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate the presentation. This is an information item. If there's no more comments, we'd like to move to the next item.
Okay. Thank you.
The last information item is the Strategic Intermodal System, SIS, Policy Plan Update. Christine Fasiska.
Sorry, Madam Chair, we missed one.
Oh, I missed one? I apologize. Oh,
I'll be quick.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the Pedestrian Bicycle Quarterly Fatal Crash Analysis.
Great, thank you. And I'll be quick. I know Christine Fasiska is here from FDOT for the next presentation. I want to give her enough time because I know we're running short here. So what this is Pedestrian Bicycle Quarterly Fatal Crash Analysis. And this is for January 2021 to June 2021. So we're looking at a little bit more than a quarter in this first half of 2021. And really what this is something that was a TPA board direction for us to consider starting to do. And then this was an action that was presented by Jessica in our Vision Zero action plan. So this is one of those actions that we were starting to report on. And why we're focusing directly on these pedestrian bicycle fatalities, because they make up a disproportionate share of the total fatalities out there when you compare the fatalities of pedestrian bicyclists to the actual people on the using our roadway system. Because they're under 5% of our mode split, but they make up 27% of our total fatalities. And really what these are is they're supposed to be pretty high level. It's really about promoting discussion and creating the sense of urgency of this issue and keeping it on the forefront of our minds as we have our committees and our board and we're going to our day-to-day with how we evaluate and prioritize projects here in the county. So you're not going to see a very detailed level of analysis for every single crash. But if there are trends that we're seeing and there are some countermeasures that we can look into, we want to get into that in more detail for these specific crashes to see if there are notable things that we can change out there. So for the summary for this first half of the year, these are all the ones that we were able to get reports for so far from the crash database system that we use at the statewide level. This comes from Signal 4. So for January 1 through June 30th, we have four fatal bicycle crashes and 29 fatal pedestrian crashes. And there's a map on the right there. You can show where those are located. A lot of them are clustering around major arterials that have abundant commercial uses surrounding them, which leads to a lot of pedestrian activity. So you'll see a lot on Okeechobee Boulevard there, and then also a little more south on Congress Ave. And something of note for this first half here is we did see three occurring on January 1st after midnight. So during New Year's, there's three just on that one day within a few hours time span. And you also see the next time we present this for the next quarter three of 2021, we saw a few crashes already come in for July, and some of those are centered around July 4th as well at night. So there are some increases in fatalities during those events. The next I wanted to mention that we see in this summary is 25 occurred at dark. So majority of these were at night on our roadways. And in our report here, our consultant noted that there's 16 locations identified with lighting on the police report. So the police officer marked that it was dark outside, but there was lighting around there. Our consultant wanted to make mention to us though that in these instances, even though it says lighting on the report, this isn't really adequately reflect the lighting that might be needed for a pedestrian or bicyclist out there, right? So a lot of that is roadway lighting. So it really is gonna take more of a direct evaluation of that specific location to determine if lighting is required for pedestrians. My last slide here, next steps. So we're hoping to incorporate more feedback from committees and stakeholders
to see how we can make this more useful and streamline this process with refining this process for review, and then trying to continue to build and refine our countermeasures. So the first ones you see here might be ones that we try to refine moving forward as you get better at this process, and then working with stakeholders to implement these refined measures where we can find some either some quick wins or some notable things that we can do to alleviate these concerns in the future. So that's all I have.
Thank you. Are there any committee member comments at this time? Are there any public comments on this item?
No, Madam Chair. And I don't see any committee members with hands raised.
Okay, thank you. So last item, Christine, for the SIS policy plan update.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Christine Fasiska. I'm the Transportation Planning Manager for FDOT at District 4. And I'm really excited to be here today and appreciate the opportunity to share with you the SIS policy plan update. So if you're not familiar, as Duane had mentioned earlier, we love our acronyms, and SIS stands for the Strategic Intermodal System. So my goal today is to inform you about the purpose of the plan, why it matters, highlight the plan elements and emphasis areas, discuss the proposed focus areas, but most importantly, to get your input and initial feedback. So the Strategic Intermodal System is a statewide network of high priority transportation facilities, including the state's largest and most significant airports, spaceports, public seaports, freight rail terminals, passenger rail and intercity bus terminals, rail corridors, waterways, and highways. Florida established the SIS in 2003 for many reasons, all of which are still relevant today. The primary reason was to help meet growing demand for moving people and freight on all modes as our population and economy continued to expand. The SIS was envisioned to support Florida's economic competitiveness by connecting our regions to markets within our nation and worldwide. Many industries require access to multiple modes of transportation, providing seamless flow of both people and goods. In addition, the SIS was intended to support the state's community planning goals by focusing transportation investments on existing transportation hubs and corridors, so we can maximize the use of the existing system. And finally, the SIS was intended to focus our essential state resources on those transportation facilities most critical to Florida's economy and quality of life. Florida statute requires the department to update the SIS policy plan at least once every 5 years following the update to the Florida Transportation Plan. The plan's developed to reviewing the most recent FTP goals and objectives to ensure the SIS policy plan is consistent with the FTP. In addition, the process considers current trends and conditions, including applicable performance measures, to ensure the plan addresses key issues and opportunities for the SIS. The process requires collaboration and input gathered through various partner and public outreach efforts, such as partner briefings, social media outreach, virtual outreach, and surveys. The 35-member steering committee that guided the update of the FTP in 2020 is assisting with the update of the SIS policy plan this year. A public comment period will accompany the draft final plan. Following the public comment period and final management approval, the final plan will be adopted. And later in the presentation, I'll show you the specific schedule for the SIS update. The SIS is made up of two basic components: SIS facilities, which meet high levels of people and goods movement, generally supporting major flows of interregional, interstate, and international trips, and strategic growth facilities, which are smaller in nature and generally are designated to support niche markets, underserved geographic areas, or other unique economic communities. And the SIS includes three types of facilities: hubs, such as airports, seaports, and other types of terminals; corridors, such as highways, rail lines, and waterways, and connectors, which link the hubs and corridors, or hubs to other hubs, and military access facilities to corridors. So statewide, the CIS includes a variety of these facilities. We have 18 commercial service airports and 3 general aviation reliever airports, 2 spaceports, 12 public seaports, 7 freight rail terminals, and 1 intermodal logistics center. We have 15 interregional passenger terminals, rail or bus. We have 2 urban fixed guideway transit corridors, including the Tri-Rail and SunRail. We have 9 military access facilities, nearly 2,200 miles of rail corridors, 900 miles of waterway corridors, and more than 4,400 miles of highway corridors. And this map shows the facilities currently designated as part of the CIS within District 4. Although the outline of the plan has evolved over the years, the CIS policy document generally addresses and includes the following topics. It defines objectives for how we plan and manage the CIS, consistent with the broader goals of the FTP. It outlines focus areas for the CIS that are to be addressed over the next 5 years as part of the plan update. It sets forth policies or strategies directed towards these objectives and focus areas. And lastly, it sets forth implementation guidance on how to carry the plan forward. So here are the current objectives in the 2016 CIS policy plan. These objectives are still correlate to the current FTP goals related to mobility, transportation choices, and economic competitiveness, and represent the longstanding framework of the CIS in its original intent. The 2022 CIS policy plan will look at these 5 focus areas. Safety: how does the CIS as a key element of the state's transportation system contribute to our vision of eliminating fatalities and serious injuries on Florida's transportation system? Resilience: how can we reduce vulnerabilities of CIS infrastructure to risk, including extreme weather, sea level rise, coastal and inland flooding, wildfires, and extreme heat? Technology and innovation: how do we prepare the CIS for emerging technologies such as automated, connected, electric, and shared vehicles? Urban mobility and connectivity: how do we address the impact of congestion in both major and developing urban areas on the efficiency and reliability of the CIS for interregional travel, especially in areas where there are limited options for adding capacity to the CIS or limited modal alternatives to CIS highways? And then lastly, rural mobility and connectivity. How can the CIS support rural revitalization and economic development and facilitate emergency evacuation and response while supporting environmental stewardship goals and community visions? So within those 5 focus areas, the CIS policy plan will identify 3 sets of CIS-related policies. The designation policy, where we'll ask which types of facilities are a statewide significance and should be part of the CIS, and what criteria should be used to designate these facilities. And then the needs and prioritization policies, where we identify what types of investments should be funded through the CIS program and what factors should be used to set priorities. And then also planning and collaboration policies, where we ask how should we work with MPOs, local governments, modal and other partners to accomplish the CIS objectives. So today I'll only focus on one of the focus areas. It's the 4th area, urban mobility and connectivity, and would like to gather some input from you all. The key issue here is the impact of congestion on the efficiency and reliability of the CIS and the ability of the CIS to play its role in supporting interregional travel. More than 86% of all delay on the CIS is focused in the 7 largest MPOs. And the Palm Beach TPA and the Broward MPO are 2 of those seven largest MPOs, and those are the two that are in our district. Total delay on the CIS highways in these seven largest MPOs is higher than it was 5 years ago. Congestion can impede the flow of interregional trips, particularly in urban areas where there are limited options for adding capacity to CIS corridors and few modal alternatives, either for through trips or for local and regional trips that currently use the CIS. Because this is a complex issue, and as we think about the solutions, we need to keep in mind that the statutory purpose of the CIS is to support statewide and interregional travel. We also need to remember that current statutes, policies, and work program instructions generally limit the use of CIS funds to those facilities designated as part of the CIS. So with that, some of the potential policy changes being considered to better address CIS mobility and connectivity in urban areas are shown here on this slide. Under the designation policies, currently there's no standard definition of interregional since the economic regions originally used were sunset a few years ago. The current CIS designation considers connections between urbanized areas, and we need to assess changes as the urban areas and MPO boundaries are adjusted over the next few years. We also can explore whether better real-time and location-based data can help better identify the facilities that actually carry significant interregional movement of people and freight, not just those that cross boundaries. Under the needs and prioritization policies, consideration is given to redefining capacity projects to include mobility and reliability improvements, such as the use of TSMNO or transportation system management and operation strategies. We could also consider balance in an interregional with intra-regional, so regional versus local needs, recognizing that in urban areas, the CIS facilities often play dual roles. So improving mobility for both purpose is key. This might include projects to create express or through lanes, create bypasses or other alternatives to bottlenecks, support truck parking or other freight accommodations. And this also might include providing more options for travel within and between Florida's urban areas. We could consider providing flexibility for use of CIS funds to support emerging mobility solutions, for example, first and last mile solutions for CIS hubs. We could consider providing flexibility for use of CIS funds off system when that is considered the best option to improve performance of the CIS. For example, if a CIS corridor is heavily congested and there are no viable options to add capacity to that corridor, we could use CIS funds to improve a parallel arterial or transit corridor if that improvement would pull local trips off the CIS and preserve that capacity for long distance travel. And then lastly, under the planning and collaboration policies, we could look at strengthening coordination with MPOs and local governments on solutions to support end-to-end trips, strengthen coordination on multimodal corridor plans that would provide integrated solutions for addressing both CIS and off-CIS facilities, and reflect compatible land uses. So for example, we have the I-95 corridor mobility planning project in Southeast Florida. And then lastly, we could improve coordination of CIS investments and local land use decisions. So this is your opportunity to provide your initial thoughts on the draft. And what we'd like to hear today is what you think, you know, are we on the right track? What are we missing? And we'd like to get your suggestions and concerns. We value your input and would be, we will be collecting any feedback that you have today. And there'll also be additional ways to provide your input. So today this presentation focused only on one of the five focus areas, but there are opportunities to provide more feedback on this topic and also the other four focus areas and any other public comments. And we'll soon be having a CIS virtual room be launched where you can learn more about the different focus areas and then also provide feedback. And that will be available 24/7. The team was finalizing the logistics of the virtual room yesterday. So we're hoping to get that launched either today or later this week. And as I mentioned earlier about the schedule, right now targeted outreach is happening through October. Also, as the draft policy plan is being updated through November of this year. And in following the outreach efforts, the draft recommendations will be incorporated into the plan based on the input that we receive. And that information will be reviewed with the FTP and CIS Implementation Committee and FDOT Management. And then in mid-December, the draft CIS policy plan will be posted for public comment. And the final plan is anticipated to be adopted by early 2022. So I'd like to hear your thoughts. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to try and answer them. Or you can also contact Ron Kariva. Ron is the District 4 CIS coordinator, and you can contact him via email or phone. And his contact information is shown here. And thank you again. I appreciate this opportunity.
All right. Thank you so much, Michael Fitzpatrick. You probably need to turn on your, yes.
Yeah, there we go. First is the courses, some of the courses I took kind of indicated that you said you could use some money to do arterial roads adjacent or to like pull local traffic off for long range travel and stuff. Well, the stuff I was told in school that usually what happens, does this actually work? Because what I was told is, no, the second road just fills up as much as the first road and you're still back where you started from. Does it, so if you have, you have any examples of where you funded parallel roads for local traffic and it's actually pulled stuff off?
We do have some programs where we can fund, we have the TRIP program where we can fund off-system facilities with state funds. But a lot of this is really to see where the funding is best used.
My question is, did it actually work? Did the trips, number of trips on the main roads go down after these secondary roads were built?
Yeah, I don't have those details here that I can share with you today.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good comment. I do think that there's a certain level of diversion, right? If you have a parallel network.
Is it measurable?
It is, but also you could also look at it from an induced demand perspective. You know, capacity will always fill up if there's enough capacity there. So even if you provide a parallel network, that essentially trips are continually going to grow on the main line regardless.
And my second question is for the future, not listed, but it's really close now, is I only a couple years out, is like Hyperloops. And what I'm reading is they're by 2022, they'll have working models and stuff. And so they'll be ready to go full time. And my question is the state of Florida ready for Hyperloops? They might have the technology there and ready to go. Will there be places in these corridors where they can build?
Yeah, I have no information to give you on Hyperloop, so I can try.
Is your group even discussing them?
I can take it back to our traffic folks, but nothing that I am aware of right now.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. I have Ramona here, and then I see Paula with your hands up. So Ramona.
Thank you, Christine, for presenting this. It's the CIS policy plan update. I have a question just piggybacking on the CIS virtual room and what you were talking about, like having public comment open. What can we as a Citizens Advisory Committee do to help our fellow citizens know about the public comment period? Like we just post the link that you talked about or whatnot. So thank you.
Sure. Once it's been open, we'll share that information with all of the committees and the board members. And you can certainly pass that out as well. And then on our end, we're also trying to get the word out, you know, through different surveys, media efforts, you know, that sort of thing where people know that they can go and give comments. But if you can pass that along to folks in your area, that would be great too.
Yeah, I think in my respective city, I know that people are very active on Nextdoor. I would recommend that you reach out to, you know, the PIO for each cities and Nextdoor, social media, Facebook. There's a very active group of very engaged citizens on those media.
Excellent.
Last comment or Paula.
Yes, hi, thank you, Christine. Great presentation. My comments, feedback to what you've presented here, I'll go in order of the last that you talked about. First of all, flexibility is key, you know, in anything and everything that we do, particularly these projects are long-term and, you know, things change. And so glad to see FDOT adding that into their language more and more. The adding use of funds for different mobility options, I think that's fabulous. There have been pilot programs all over the country. I think that, you know, embedding it into the funding options here would be great for communities. Improve coordination and land use. That's always been my number one goal, is that FDOT would help coordinate land use along these corridors that would enable us to do things like east-west rail. You know, the real impediment to getting people off corridors or off major arterials is just not having any other option but to get into a car. So if we can look at how land use can be incentivized, so to speak, on the front end with the local municipalities where FDOT takes the lead and says, you know, I understand that, you know, you want to see rail or alternative mobility, but you've got land use in one town, Green Acres, Palm Springs, I'll just use, you know, Palm Beach County, and not everybody has the same policies. So I think that is probably the biggest piece that will get us to alternative mobility options, is getting local government funding incentives to coordinate land use policies. And then you also talked about the definition of CIS. That's great. You know, changing it, adding it, expanding it to incorporate what we've learned and what we see, you know, for today and the future. So those are my comments. I hope they're helpful. And I appreciate, you know, the work that you guys are putting into this. And thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I don't see, are there, Margie, any public comments on this item?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. And I don't see any other members with their hands raised. Thanks, Christine.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's very difficult, but you can do it. So at this point, I'm going to turn back to members' comment as requested by Michael Fitzpatrick earlier.
Thank you. I got about three paragraphs. First one is a little historical background to give context, perhaps. I believe it was November 1942 when the U.S. Army invaded North Africa in Operation Torch. After the front was stabilized, Churchill, Roosevelt, and staff met in Casablanca to plan out how to destroy Nazi Germany. They hammered out goals to do specific tasks such as win the Battle of the Atlantic, sink all the U-boats, bomb Germany, industry, and cities, shoot down all the Luftwaffe planes. And I'm reading a book which focuses on the people, the middle managers who actually made these goals happen. The relevance of how decisions and processes were made in 1942 and 43 to today is, with global warming, we are engaged in an important struggle, as was World War II. August 5th, 2021, President Biden announced a similar aspirational goal. By 2030, 50% of all new cars sold in the United States be electric. Like sinking U-boats in 1942, Nobody today in 2021 knows the nuts and bolts of how to achieve this goal. I am interested in helping making this goal happen in Palm Beach County. If others on this committee are like-minded, I propose we form an ad hoc subcommittee and develop a roadmap to present to the governing board. So if anybody else likes this kind of stuff, please contact me and we can work on it. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, sure. I do know that Michael just asked for members to contact him directly. I did want to remind the committee that they are held under Sunshine Law requirements. So if they did want to form an ad hoc committee, it would need to be in the sunshine. So during a meeting, members should not contact each other about an item that would come before the committee.
I believe the relevant portions of it. And if it's informational gathering and you don't limit any options like pre-select and things not to do, then, and we are not filling out any forms for money and stuff, we have no real decision-making process. So please show me the parts of the code that apply to us, because I couldn't find them.
Yes, I can definitely share that with you. It is also a requirement under our operating procedures that an advisory committee or the executive director may form an ad hoc committee, but they shall report to the advisory committee that formed them. So if the CAC is looking to create an ad hoc committee, they will need to report back to the CAC. And we do ask that it is a diverse representation of its members. And Madam Chair, I do have Paula Ryan with her hand raised.
Yes, Paula Ryan.
Thank you. I just wanted to add to what Marjorie said, and that is that we are all subject to the Florida Sunshine laws, and it is arduous and overbearing and challenging on many, many fronts, but what Marjorie said is correct. We are not supposed to be communicating with each other about things that pertain to this board.
Show me where it says that, because I read it too and I don't see it this instance.
If Michael is asking for an ad hoc committee to be made up of CAC members and to contact him to have an ad hoc committee be created. The TPA would like that to be done during an advertised meeting such as today with the membership makeup outline and the purpose and topic of the ad hoc committee to be outlined. So it's clear for TPA staff that we'll need to facilitate the meeting. Again, because you are a TPA advisory committee.
I think that I don't know the actual rules of an ad hoc committee. Maybe James, you have more information on this.
Well, I don't know the rules of an ad hoc committee for an advisory committee, but my suggestion would be that Mike put something together as an action item on the next agenda or the agenda after that for his ad hoc committee. You know, give it notice. It'll go out with a notice for the same meeting, and we can comply with the sunshine rules, and we can have a discussion of the proposed ad hoc committee within the parameters of the sunshine law, because you got to give notice, it's got to be open to the public, things of that nature. So why don't you put together a proposal, meet with staff, put together an action item for either the next meeting or the meeting afterwards, and then we can have a discussion about it.
That's agreeable to me.
Okay. We'll be looking forward to the next agenda. Let's advertise.
And Madam Chair, I do have Myron with his hand raised as well.
I apologize, Myron.
Well, I was about to say the same thing that I think James said. I couldn't hear him, but the idea was put something on the next agenda, have conversation with staff and develop an agenda item for our next meeting.
Myron, bright minds think alike, I guess. Yes, that's what I tried to convey.
Okay. So I guess the direction is for Michael Fitzpatrick to get with staff, establish an action item for the next agenda in reference to the ad hoc committee. Okay. All right. Are there any administrative item at this time? Seeing none, the next meeting is October 6th, 2021. Thank you so much. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.